Farmers in Illinois have seen their incomes drop the past 3 years, bad enough in some cases to put them out of business. Crop insurance has kept many farmers afloat, but is the program too costly? We'll find out. Plus, can bad science in the movies actually make good lessons for the classroom?
This grass spider hunts using a set of reflexes with nerve conduction velocity so fast that some researchers believe it almost borders on precognition. A spider sense.
Entomologist Mae Barenbaum joins us to discuss how to teach science through bad examples. And with hurricanes, tropical storms, and fires in the news this week, what's the role of climate change in all of this, and what does it mean for Illinois?
Water's breached the top of the levee, and since then, we haven't had any chance to have that repaired. Pretty severe in the effects it could have on our community and the river trade as well.
That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. The latest news is next. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Scott Cameron, sitting in for Nyla Boodoo. Ask most farmers in Illinois and they'll tell you if you like buying your food at a price you can afford, then crop insurance is important. It protects farmers' income during the bad years, and ag makes up a large part of Illinois' economy, everything from what you eat to how you gas up your car. But others say the crop insurance program costs taxpayers too much, doesn't reach the farmers who need it most. Now, there's a federal report that recommends cutting hundreds of millions of dollars from that program. What does crop insurance mean to Illinois farmers, and are there ways to make the program better or more efficient? Joining us on the line now to talk more about this and its place in Illinois' ag economy is Doug Yoder. He's crop agency manager at Country Financial in Illinois, one of a relatively small group of insurers around the country here who sell crop insurance. Doug, thanks for joining us. Welcome to the 21st.
Well, my pleasure, Scott. Thanks for having me on.
So over the past 3 years now, I mean, farmers have seen their income drop. It's been tough. This year, I looked at some of the estimates, and it's expected to be somewhat better, but you know, income levels are still lower than about 2010 or so. But what role does crop insurance play, I guess, to start, in terms of Illinois farmers being able to do what they do, to grow our food?
Absolutely, Scott. Crop insurance has definitely turned itself into the cornerstone of support and protection that farmers rely on, and they invest heavily in it. 2012, that the last really significant drought we had Corn Belt wide, crop insurance literally protected farmers and kept them in business.
And whole crop, and people around here will remember that, the whole crops lost. There was a water shortage across
exactly.
The board. That was a tough one.
It is, and that's what crop insurance is designed to do, is protect against natural causes of loss, such as drought, flood, disease, you know, insects, things that, there's so many things outside of farmers' control.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they try their best. They spend a lot of money to grow that crop. It's very capital intensive, and they do their best, but there are certain things, literally, we just cannot control, and that's what crop insurance is designed to do. Again, as you mentioned to start the show, in order to provide our nation's citizens a stable, safe, abundant food supply.
So I think most people understand, you know, say car insurance or health insurance. So you pay money. There's this sort of a shared risk pool. You know, you pay your money every month. Something bad happens, like you mm-hmm. mentioned there in 2012. You're covered financially. You know, crop insurance often described as the main safety net for farmers, something that can keep them in business during some of these periods, like the drought or market downturns. You know, when prices may go low. You know, how does it work? How does it do that exactly?
Several choices farmers can make annually. They can either protect losses due to yield declines, or they can protect revenue losses. And that's typically what 90% of Illinois farmers buy, is revenue protection. So that would cover both yield losses and price drops. Farmers can't control the prices on the exchanges either. So that's their choices. And then they're, just like you mentioned, any insurance has deductible. Most farmers in Illinois buy what we call individual lines of insurance, protecting their individual farms. The maximum coverage level they can buy is 85% in those lines. So at a minimum, they have a 15% deductible. And most of us have a couple hundred, maybe a $500 deductible on our mm-hmm. car insurance. A 15% deductible on your business revenue is substantial. They literally have to lose at minimum 15% of their business revenue before the policies even kick in.
Before it kicks
Farmers
in.
Spend a lot of money on this coverage, and obviously they're highly invested, not only from a premium standpoint that they purchase, but also in that large deductible. So they certainly share in the risk.
And there are two things that you mentioned that I think are important, especially, and the farmers will know this, you'll know this, but you know, folks like me may not. So you mentioned there the protection for yield, and that's kind of what you described that happened in 2012. If the crop is not there, if you don't have product to sell, there's protection. Then you also mentioned the price protection there. How does that work? How does the price vary, and when does that kick in?
Farmers rely on the Chicago Board of Trade, for example, here in Illinois for our crops, corn, beans, wheat. They're traded. Price discovery is done on the Chicago Board of Trade, and that's the prices that farmers receive. Of course, their local elevators adjust that price for local conditions, but that's where it all starts. Crop insurance measures that Chicago Board of Trade price twice a year, in February and then again in October following harvest, to measure that price increase or decrease during that time period. And that's what is some coverage is provided for that.
Okay. And so that's if there's a glut in the market or something, if prices fall, there's some protection, some supports.
That's exactly right. And that's typically how it works. If we have bumper crops, we have good yields, well then prices drop substantially and farmers' revenues still go down. So that's why the vast majority of farmers who invest in this, and obviously that revenue insurance is considerably more expensive than yield only expense coverage, but that's what most farmers in Illinois choose to take just because they need that added price protection.
And the vast majority, I understand, of corn and soybean farmers in Illinois are covered by some one of these forms of crop insurance you've talked about. Why has it become so popular? I mean, is it the obvious, just that this is there, that protection is there, and that it makes sense for them, or what? Is there other reasons out there?
It is. It's such a highly capitalized venture. For example, last year, University of Illinois estimates, you know, to plant 1 acre of corn is about $850 to $890 at various parts of Illinois. Mm. So it's very capital intensive. So many risks out of their control. Even though farmers are very adept and good at using modern technology, there's still things out of their control. This business insurance is vital to keep them in operation, in business from year to year. And as we've seen, their expenses continue to rise over time with inflation. You know, the market doesn't always keep up. Sometimes the grain market collapses like it's currently doing now. That's led to a 3 to 4 year, you know, net income drop on U.S. agriculture. So, and it's certainly been a long process, Scott. If you go back 20 years, farmers did not use crop insurance anywhere near to the extent that we do now. But Congress has made some conscious efforts to improve the product over time with a lot of input from folks like us out here in the industry that work with farmers every day. We really needed to improve the product to get it to where it was a viable business tool. And we've done that over time, and the farmers have certainly learned to use it for their protection.
So getting to the, you know, this GAO report, and it's certainly not the first time that folks have suggested cuts or changes to the program in order to save money. And, I mean, I should point out, too, that most people, at least on official levels, seem to agree that crop insurance is important, is needed in some form. I'm not seeing people say that should go away completely, you know, but the GAO, Environmental Group Working Group, you know, others are arguing that it needs to, I guess the term might be more efficient, less wasteful, more focused on some of the farmers that need it most. You know, do you see, I mean, so in your business, you're working with a lot of farmers, certainly you sell crop insurance, so you're directly invested, you know, in some model out there of crop insurance. But do you see ways to tweak the program, ways that the program could be better, could be more efficient, could be fixed?
Well, and I would say yes. And typically, you know, we always look at ways to better improve the product because just like any insurance, farmers don't buy the insurance hoping to get a claim, but they need that protection in case a claim comes along. And here in Illinois, even with all the risk I've described, we're still sitting on some of the best dirt, some of the best growing conditions in the world, and we still have many years out of 10, the majority of years, farmers do not get a claim back. They expend hundreds of thousands of dollars annually each person for this coverage, not getting a claim back. But when they do have a claim, then obviously it can be sizable. So yes, there's always ways that we're looking to improve the product. In something this size, I have no doubt that there is ways somewhat to tweak expenses. And farmers are tax-paying citizens too. They're all in favor of reducing, eliminating fraud, waste, and abuse. So we're certainly on board with that. But we also want to be conscious that we don't overdo it and jeopardize the viability of this program. Because without this program, well, let me back up, Scott. This program has allowed Congress to not pass disaster assistance for agriculture for a long time now. Before we had a viable safety net with crop insurance, Congress is annually and being asked to analyze, do they need to spend off-budget money on disaster programs to keep certain parts of agriculture in place here in the U.S.? They haven't had to do that for a long time now, thanks to crop insurance. So yes, we're all in favor of looking for ways to, you know, eliminate excessive cost. But I'll be honest, we've done that considerably already. 2009, 2011, two different chunks were large, like $10 billion were saved in crop insurance in those two times alone. So there has been some fairly recent attempts to, you know, to downsize some of the expenses. So we just want to make sure that we're not overdoing that.
And certainly coming up.
The other metric I can throw out there as well.
Yeah, real quick.
Back in the highlight, there is about 47 companies approved to sell crop insurance in the U.S. Now we're down to 16. That tells you a lot right there. It's not overly lucrative. If those companies are getting out like that, it tells me a lot that you know, we have downsized a fair amount already.
Mm-hmm. It's Doug Yoder, Crop Agency Manager, Country Financial here in Central Illinois. Doug, thanks for joining us. I appreciate you kind of pulling back the curtain there.
Scott, anytime. My pleasure. Thanks for the opportunity.
All right, take care. And joining us now here in studio, Pam Dempsey, Executive Director of the Midwest Center for Investigative Reporting. Done a lot of reporting on this issue in particular, as well as a lot around agriculture. Pam, welcome to the 21st.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So, Doug, there kind of, you know, you heard him make the case for the value of crop insurance in Illinois. You know, there are these efforts to cut back the program to save taxpayers money, among other reasons. You know, your group has covered this in the past. A recent story, you know, with the headline, Government Watchdog Recommends Steep Cuts to Crop Insurance Companies. What specifically are some of the changes that they're looking at?
So GEO addresses this issue. It has the Government Accountability Agency has done so. They're a nonpartisan government agency that sort of looks at something, as my understanding, pretty objectively. And their latest look at the crop insurance program evaluates cuts that to percentages insurers get from this. So it's important to know that insurance companies receive in 2016, for example, about $2.6 billion for its share in underwriting gains from the program.
And so this is the companies, the money the companies get, not the money that goes to the farmers.
Exactly, exactly. For servicing, there's also an additional $1.4 billion fee they received in 2016 to service the program for so their administrative and operating cost to service the farmers. The latest GAO report, which was released last week, looked at cuts to the percentages the insurance companies get to the tune of about $400 million a year. They were reducing their percentages slightly.
So this, that's out of, what, $8 or $9 billion, I think, is what the...
Yeah, definitely. When they're looking at the percentage cuts, it's just it's depending on the premiums they make. And then, of course, certainly the administrative fee to service the program. So you're looking at $400 million average a year reduction to the insurance companies. And as I noted, in 2016, they received almost $4 billion to service and to provide insurance.
For those, have you, you know, obviously, Doug there is talking from the perspective of somebody who sells the insurance and obviously is directly invested there. Farmers often, you know, speak in favor of this. Have you or any reporters spoken to farmers, you know, in Illinois or in the region here that, you know, who are critical of crop insurance in some way?
I don't think that it's so much the criticism of the program itself. I mean, there certainly have been abuses in the past, and people that we've spoken with have maybe touched on that, yes, on occasion, or there are maybe a farmer who gets into the business or you maybe abuse the insurance program for the money, but it seems to be more the exception rather than the rule. I mean, most farmers we've spoken with, have interviewed, have seemed very supportive of this program because as Doug pointed out, it certainly is a safety net. There are a lot of things that farmers cannot control, and it certainly is a safety net for them to do what they do.
What about lawmakers? Because, you know, the GEO puts out a report. It's making a recommendation. President Trump put out, you know, sort of a preliminary budget several months back and made deep cuts, actually, across a lot of aspects of USDA, and including crop insurance and other sort of price things for farmers. But at the end of the day, it's Congress that sets that budget, the House of Representatives. What about lawmakers right now? Are we seeing or hearing anything from them, whether it be in the region or across the country, about taking on an issue like this or acting on the GAO recommendations?
It definitely comes up regularly. It definitely seemed so ahead of the last farm bill in 2014. We did see a lot of conversation around cutting this program in some ways to the farmers directly. In some cases, there have been even GAO reports. They've been even some legislation that looked at capping the amount of premium subsidies a farmer can get to $40,000 per year. I believe that was reflected in Trump's proposed budget in May. So lawmakers, certainly Wisconsin, have suggested this. There's a representative out of Arizona who has frequently since 2013, again in 2015, suggested some of the cuts, the very same cuts that we saw in Trump's budget earlier this year.
You mentioned some of the numbers, and we only got about a minute left here, but We're focused primarily here because of this GAO report on the money that goes to the administrative costs, the insurance companies, not the farmers. You know, we did hear Doug tell us that Illinois farmers pay quite a bit of money out of pocket for their insurance policies, and they take a significant portion of the risk there. A portion of this, though, is covered by government subsidies. Is that right?
Yes. 62% or 62 cents on the dollar is covered by the federal government. So a farmer who hypothetically, say, pays $100 an acre, and again, hypothetically, for crop insurance, they pay about $38 and the government pays $62.
Okay. All right. And then going forward, I mean, obviously part of the reason that this is coming up now is the Farm Bill is back up for negotiation. They're already talking about it now, as you can tell from this report. You know, come 2018 and things, I mean, just in the next 15 seconds here, what should we watch out for here as this Farm Bill comes up and people start digging into the numbers here?
Yeah, I think with the farm income being so low, I think you will definitely see more conversation on cuts to the insurance companies. Important to note, though, however, with the Farm Bill, crop insurance only comprises about 8% of that budgeted. In the last, 80% goes to nutrition programs like the food stamp program. So while we're throwing out big numbers, we're talking billions of dollars, you're looking at last Farm Bill was almost $1 trillion. And 80% of that went to nutrition and supplemental food programs.
All right. Well, you can read much more about this at the Midwest Center for Investigative Reporting site. We will link to that, tweet out some of the links. That's Pam Dempsey, the executive director of the Midwest Center. Thanks for coming in. Thanks for talking to us.
Thanks for having me.
And coming up here next, we're going to talk with an entomologist about how bad science in the movies can help teachers in the classroom. Stay with us. You're listening to The 21st. Thanks for listening to The 21st. I'm Scott Cameron, sitting in for Nyla Boodoo today. You know, movies are often chock full of bad science, but entomologist Mae Barenbaum says that bad science could do a lot of good as a teaching tool in the classroom. That's the subject of a presentation she'll be giving tomorrow, titled Science Fiction in the Classroom, Teaching Science Through Bad Examples. We'll tweet out all that information. Follow us at 21st Show. Have it available over on our website, too. But Mae Barenbaum joins us now in studio to talk more about all this. A professor at the University of Illinois, awarded the National Medal of Science, I have to brag. Welcome back to The 21st. Thanks for being here.
A pleasure. Though I did not get the National Medal for anything related to science fiction. So.
Well, you should have, I think. Maybe it was an oversight on their part. But you know, there is so much bad science in movies. I mean, I'm thinking, you know, flux capacitors, man-eating ants.
Don't forget reversing the polarity.
Reversing the polarity. I mean, there really are so many examples. How can all that bad information, do you think, be used as a teaching tool?
Well, not so much the bad information as the nugget of reality on which the bad science is constructed.
So there's often something in there?
Often, if you search hard enough, there's a sliver of reality, and it provides a sort of an entree into a discussion that students almost invariably find more engaging than setting up to lecture on, say, insect physiology.
I mean, is that a big part of it then, too, sort of reaching, you know, keeping younger kids maybe interested in science by sort of meeting them on a field that they're already on?
Absolutely. There was a Redbox study that showed over a year, people on average see as many as 84 bits and pieces of up to 84 movies and can see 5,000 movies in a lifetime. So they're already prepping for class in that sense. So
anyway, so let's, I think we should hear some of this and talk a little about what we're talking. So I'm thinking back here. So the movie Tobey Maguire, 2002, I think, Spider-Man, you know, one of the sci-fi movies that you recommend for the teaching of science.
This grass spider hunts using a set of reflexes with nerve conduction velocity so fast that some researchers believe it almost borders on precognition, a spider sense.
With nerve velocity speed so great. What are you hearing there? Why this film?
Well, it is one of the top grossing movies of all time, domestic box office. And in fact, a lot of probably 80% of the top 25 box office hits domestically have some science content. And Spider-Man is just, everybody knows the backstory here.
Yeah, and that was it. I mean, that was the scene, right? He's bitten by the spider. It has superpowers, you know. Is there a nugget of reality that...
Well, spiders do bite.
That's true.
And they do inject venom. And there are examples in the arthropod world of extremely fast signaling in... what are called giant axons. One reason cockroaches can scuttle away so quickly when you flip a light on is that they have very large nerves that transmit signals really, really quickly. So that opens up all kinds of discussions about what the remarkable physiological capabilities of real arthropods are.
Yeah.
And the constraints, because spiders all also produce silk. They don't do it with those little web shooter things that are on the wrist.
Well, depending on the movie, it may be on the wrist or it may be built in. We, you know, it just depends.
Yeah, spiders, it's on their butts for the most part. And I don't think that was
movie
very cinematic there to have
a very different kind
Tobey
of movie,
Maguire,
I suppose,
aiming at the, But there you go. So it's not only interesting and memorable, it can even be kind of entertaining how... screenwriters will often explain things away. There's a movie called Glass Trap, which has a bit of a real ecology in it. Yeah. Ants are transported all over the world, often in plant material, because they're very small. You can't see them. It's a major problem. There are invasive ants all over the United States, for example. We have fire ants that are causing problems. They're from South America. Argentine ants are displacing our native ants. They move around the world. In Glass Trap, they arrive in Los Angeles in a cargo hold of a ship where they shared space with a leaking plutonium from a terrorist cell.
There's always leaking radiation.
And of course, this turned them into giants. One of my favorite lines in the film, where a screenwriter kind of probably just blocked off space, they're wondering how they got that big, and one of the characters says, maybe they work out. So in reality, ants and spiders and Jeff Goldblum, when he becomes transformed into a fly, because of the laws of physics, couldn't walk on ceilings. Even if he's got fly genes, the surface area volume ratio says that he would be
too heavy.
What happens, small insects are small, and small objects have a high ratio of surface area to their volume.
Hmm.
Surface area is a factor of the square. It's an area measure. Volume is a cubic measure. So the friction works really well when you have a lot of surface area relative to your volume. That relationship breaks down the bigger you get. So if he tried to walk on the ceiling, he would fall down.
He would fall down and go splat.
All the fly genes in the world couldn't help him.
Couldn't help him. I mean, I do wonder, you know, that is a lot of sort of bad science, you know, some bad information with little nuggets of truth in it. You know, do you worry that by showing... starting with the bad science, I guess, then trying to correct it, that the wrong idea is going to stick? Do you think this could backfire?
You know, I don't really think it could backfire because everybody seems to love criticizing movies. So if you have a fact that you can share with others that illustrates that you know more than the screenwriters or the producers, then that's a useful conversation point. And it's kind of almost a truism in the pedagogy literature that entertainment is a good way to reinforce learning.
Yeah.
And
like you said, they're seeing the movies already. I mean, it's not like you're
introducing
something new.
And they're seeing them by their free choice, not because they were assigned. You know, it was a class assignment and an hour and a half of drudgery. So anything that helps... retention and memory, I think, is useful.
Is useful. Well, let's hear one more clip here. You know, time is sort of flying by here as we're having this conversation. But so 1954, Godzilla, we have a little bit of the trailer. Let's just listen here.
This is Tokyo, once a city of 6 million people. What has happened here was caused by a force which, up until a few days ago, was entirely beyond the scope of man's imagination.
Now let's have it, Steve. What about this monster story of yours?
Well, it's big and terrible.
Big and terrible. So as you then, if there are, you know, teachers listening, as you're going to be talking tomorrow, as you're sort of making these recommendations, how do you bring something like that then into a classroom?
Well, actually, Godzilla was inspired by actual events. There was a Japanese fishing boat in 1954 called the Lucky Dragon that was sailing in the U.S. Marshall Islands when the U.S. Army was testing nuclear weapons.
Yeah.
And this was a thermonuclear device that was tested on the Bikini Atoll. And the crew and the boat and the fish catch all got contaminated by fallout.
Mm-hmm.
And then the crewmen were severely burned, and one died shortly thereafter. This was the dawn of the nuclear era, where people were awakening to the grave consequences of radioactive fallout.
Well, this guy's teaching also a really important part of history. I mean, a very serious side of history, in addition to the science that's involved in it.
Well, I mean, nuclear weapons are a classic example of how technology often outpaces the consequences. The nice thing about science fiction is that you can render the theoretical consequences mm-hmm. into a semblance of reality. As it turns out, mutation doesn't either awaken a giant prehistoric beasts or mm-hmm. mutate them. I always thought it was a nice touch that Godzilla has radioactive breath, and he was so popular, he kept coming back in films.
And battling other organisms.
Battling all kinds of other radiation-induced monstrosities. In reality, mutants are a pretty sorry lot. Very early on, the earliest workers on genetic mutation saw that overwhelmingly mutations do not enhance survival.
Hmm.
But that doesn't make for a very good storyline.
So. Right, but again, some lessons that people can bring into the classroom and, again, point to these things, drawing people's attention, drawing kids' attention, and then lay the learning on them.
Yeah, what is a mutation and why are they deleterious? And how improbable is it that a giant lizard would be spewing radioactive bad breath on a unsuspecting population of Japan? So,
I mean, as much as, you know, obviously we're here and laughing a lot of us for the bad science and films and things, you know, does part of you, though, just wish that sci-fi filmmakers would make more of an effort to get it right? Or do you think this is just sort of a necessary thing and it's part of the fun?
There are trade-offs. The most important thing in movie making is the story. And that's why you often see inspired by true events. In fact, was it Sam Goldwyn, who was one of the sort of
the big
classic
Hollywood
movie moguls, said, "Pictures are for entertainment. Messages should be delivered by Western Union." So it would compromise the storytelling. There was Hidden Figures was a marvelous movie about actual human computers, women, African American women who contributed to the space effort, and it was criticized because the book actually had a much more accurate account. And there are liberties taken to increase to heighten the drama, mm-hmm. to reduce the number of people involved. You can't have a movie in an hour and a half with 300 characters, but science does take a lot of time and a lot of people. So there's a trade-off. If it were as accurate as real science, it would probably be as boring as real science.
That is a very good point. We're going to have to leave it there. That's Mae Birenbaum, professor of entomology at the University of Illinois, speaking on campus tomorrow on this very issue and how science, the bad science of films, can be used to help teachers and students in the classroom. Mae, thank you very much. It's good to talk to you.
Always a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
You're listening to The 21st. New faster passenger trains will be coming soon here to Illinois. The announcement from the Department of Transportation and Amtrak say the new trains will be more reliable, shorten the time to get from Chicago to St. Louis, Carbondale, other cities, and the changes could come as soon as next year. Joining us now to learn more about this, why it's significant for commuters all across the state here, is Joseph Schweiderman, professor in the School for Public Service, Department of Public Policy and Sustainable Urban Development at DePaul University in Chicago. I think I got most of that right. Joseph, welcome to The 21st. Thanks for being with us.
Good morning.
And I should have said Schweiderman. I'm sorry, I got that part of it wrong. They're reading too quickly here. But so how much faster are these new trains, these locomotives, than the one that are currently operating? I mean, how big of a deal is this?
Well, it is a big deal. We're pretty excited because the corridor has been gradually improved to St. Louis. They went from 3 to 5 trains about 10 years ago, and ridership's been real nice. And now these new locomotives come, and essentially two things are happening. Amtrak is finishing up some major track work, with more passing tracks and things, because it's mostly a single track railroad. And with those passing tracks, these new locomotives are called Siemens Charger locomotives, which can accelerate really fast. They can cut significant time off the schedule when all the approvals are made. And we think eventually we're going to cut an hour off the St. Louis route.
Wow. And you mentioned that those are passing lanes. We don't have time to get into all this, but I think anybody who's ridden an Amtrak train knows that those passing lanes matter because you get stuck behind a freight train and you can wait forever sometimes. But which routes are affected? What are we talking about here in terms of who rides where?
Yeah, a few years ago, the Obama administration had a big high-speed rail package, and some of that money went to states that were sent back to Washington, like Wisconsin, famously, because they didn't have the matching funds. And Illinois got a piece of that, and Michigan and some other states. And so they've been gradually adding speed increases to go from 79, which is sort of the top speed you can go without certain kind of crossing infrastructure to prevent people from getting stuck on the tracks, all the way to 110. And so in Michigan, there's already track now running at 110 near Kalamazoo, and that's being extended fast. And in Illinois, a lot of that track is ready as well, but there's by the end of this year, there's going to be pretty long stretches ready for that. But we need the locomotives that can do it reliably. So with these new Charger locomotives, which accelerate fast, the stage is set. Now, we still need federal approval for some of the signaling, and that's always a wild card, and that probably won't be ready first the year. But everything's looking good for that to happen. And so it's nice to have a good news story in Illinois in the transportation world. It's been a while.
It is. You mentioned that we have heard a lot about high-speed rail, the difference that could make for commuters, and in some areas that is moving ahead faster than others. This is not quite that, but it sounds like this is a step in that direction.
It is, and we're not talking the TGV here, and 110 is the magic number, because in Illinois we're such a flat state that if you look at that line, from Chicago to St. Louis, it goes through Joliet and Pontiac, Bloomington, Springfield. It's flat as a pancake in many of those areas. There's just lots of highway crossings. And 110 is the highest you can go without eliminating those highway crossings.
110 miles an hour, right?
Yeah, exactly, and that's moving pretty good. So if we can hit 110 for long stretches on straight track, that's going to boost ridership. And a lot of those cities on that route really rely on being kind of a satellite of Chicago. That people, corporations, want that connection to Chicago, and trains are a big deal for them.
Yeah, and a lot of times that complaint is that if you can cut an hour off of it, I mean that starts to make it competitive with maybe flying or something else in the state. Certainly with driving. At that point, at that rate of speed. We've only got here about 20 seconds left here, but in terms of timeline, what are you looking at? You mentioned not by January, but what realistically do you think people will be able to get on one of these trains?
Well, we're waiting for the Trump administration to name a railway administrator, and when that happens, the approval process can begin in earnest. But like next month, a new station is opening in Alton. There's new stations going to be open in Lincoln, and Lincoln, they're moving back into a historic station. Dwight has a new station. Some work in Pontiac. So it's really going to be a whole new line. And I think by the end of next year, we'll have some pretty exciting trains to ride.
Nice. Well, Joseph Schweiderman, we should talk much more about this. I do appreciate the time, the brief overview today with DePaul University there in Chicago. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
The 21st is made possible by Kester & Bradley, LLP, providing legal services to the Urbana-Champaign community and Illinois residents since 1895. Kester & Bradley's attorneys are committed to achieving the best results for their clients. More information is available at KesterLawLLP.com.
Thanks for listening to The 21st. I'm Scott Cameron, sitting in for Nyla Boodoo here today. What does this recent latest outbreak of record-setting storms and other natural disasters tell us about what to expect next? Dozens of people died as a result of Hurricane Harvey. Forecasters say they've never seen a storm quite like it. Hurricane Irma pounding the Caribbean area, heading for Florida, maybe the strongest Atlantic hurricane on record. Heavy monsoons, widespread flooding, killed more than 1,000 people across India, Nepal, Bangladesh, millions forced out of their homes. Again, many people find themselves asking the question, what's the role of climate change in all of this, and what could it mean specifically for Illinois? Jim Angel is a state climatologist with the Illinois State Water Survey, a part of the Prairie Research Institute at the University of Illinois, and he joins us here in studio. Jim, welcome back to The 21st.
Yes, thanks for having me.
So I guess the question there is kind of on everybody's minds. You know, we hear over and over, climate is not weather, weather is not climate. That's important. But people do wonder, are you connecting the severe weather we're seeing right now to the effects of climate change?
Yes. If you look at climate in general, that's kind of the long-term view. But there's definitely a clear interaction between weather events and climate events. And typically what climate does is kind of set you up for how these things play out. So, for example, with Hurricane Harvey, the climate didn't cause Hurricane Harvey. But what it did with climate change was actually kind of enhanced it, in the sense that we had a warmer ocean and a warmer atmosphere, so we had a lot more moisture for it to tap into. So we probably would have had Harvey anyway, but we probably wouldn't have gotten this much rainfall out of it.
So the conditions are more ripe, more primed.
That's right, yes. It's got more fuel to work with, so more moisture in the atmosphere, that's more energy and water that the storm can tap into, and so we can get a lot more precipitation out of it. And kind of the same thing with Irma, too, is that it's tracking over very warm ocean temperatures. In fact, some of the warmest temperatures we've seen on that part of the ocean right now on record. So, you know, a lot of energy there that it can tap into. So it just makes them a lot stronger.
And just to put some of this, I guess, into perspective, and we've heard quite a bit from the reporting, even from some of the things you just said right there, but with Harvey in particular, I guess, you know, is this, what do we know? Is it the worst rainstorm in history, in recorded history? How bad was it?
Yeah, so it's definitely the most in U.S. history. There's probably other places in the world where we've had individual sites that have had more rainfall. But I would say, just looking at it, the amount of rainfall over such a large area is very impressive. We took the rainfall from Harvey and overlaid it on Illinois to kind of give you a better perspective. And if you look at the amounts, we had about 40-inch amounts going from Chicago to Rockford if RV had fallen on Illinois. So 40 inches or more falling over that large an area, you would have had to driven as far south of as Kankakee to even get out of the worst of the rainfall.
Which was 50 inches and more.
That's right, yes. So just an incredibly large amount of rain over an incredibly large area. And so it's just unimaginable how much rain that actually is.
When it adds up. You mentioned Irma. I mean, just, I guess, real quickly, and you're not in the forecast center, but does Irma look like it's going to be similar, measure up, or a very different storm?
Well, it's already a Category 5, so that's on the top category for hurricanes. And so and it's got 185-mile-an-hour winds last night. So, yeah, that one's going to add up to being one of the big ones. And we haven't seen a really big hurricane along the Gulf or Atlantic coast for quite a while. In fact, it's been really since 2005 since we've had such an active season. So, you know, I think everybody's maybe a little complacent that, you know, I kind of have some of these smaller hurricanes that did a little bit of damage. But this one's a big one. So the amount of damage could be very significant.
And some of those islands, you know, down in the Caribbean and off the coast there, Haiti and others, it could be just devastating.
That's right.
In some of these regions.
Exactly.
You know, it's fairly obvious, I guess, how coastal cities, you know, some of the islands we talked about, certainly in Houston, across, you know, Miami and Florida, are at risk from severe weather, like what we're talking about. You know, I should also mention, too, I mean, there are fires burning out west right now and things like that, too, that it also could potentially be related here. But what kinds of risks to states that are more inland? I'm obviously thinking of Illinois. You know, what are the risks there when it comes to the type of severe weather and outbreaks that we're talking about now?
That's right. If you look at the impacts of climate change on Illinois, they're a little different than what we see in other parts of the country. In some ways, they're a little more muted. I mean, we don't have to worry about sea level rise, for example. But we have seen a general increase in temperatures, and most of that has occurred in the spring and winter months. So it's actually given us a tendency to have milder winters and longer spring weather. Mm-hmm. So it may, you can debate whether that's good news or bad news, depending on how you like winter weather. But probably the one that's really given us the most fits is an increase in rainfall. Mm. So we're getting more rain in the winter and the spring and really all year round, on the order of about 10 to 15%, depending on where you are in Illinois. And a lot of that's falling is more heavy rain events. So we're getting more flooding and issues like that and soil erosion. So I would say
we saw that just a few months ago.
Yeah, that's right. Up in Chicago, we had definite problems with that back in July. So, and dollar amount wise, those have actually been our biggest impacts in Illinois from climate change, have been from the rainfall side of things.
Well, this is probably a good moment, as we're talking about flooding in Illinois, to bring another voice into this conversation. Jeff Denny is the county engineer in Alexander County. It's for the southern tip of Illinois, next to the Mississippi River. Recently on this show, we learned about a new report from the Pew Charitable Trust, which identified Alexander County there as the most flood-prone region in Illinois. Jeff, welcome to the 21st.
Glad to be here. Glad to be here.
Yeah, I appreciate the time. Now, I mean, Alexander County, you know, you've seen flooding. You've seen this kind of play out over the years. The past spring, some pretty big damage, you know, caused. Mississippi flooded. And we heard that part of the problem was a breached levee, I think, in Miller City. Principal of Tam School District explained it has been a source of concern for some time now. Why don't we go back just for a minute to that show and hear what he had to say when he spoke to him. And this is, I think it's Brett Gowan, I should say, principal there of Tam's school district. All right, we'll get that ready here in just a minute. But I think what he described was, the levee was kind of built up by farmers, and that over the course of severe rains and flooding and things like that, it was kind of wiped out, and they were trying to build it up and were having trouble doing that. I mean, can you kind of brief us a little bit, explain what happened in that area when the river flooded this year?
Yeah, I mean, basically it kind of hit the southern part of Alexander County, an area that they call Dogtooth Bend, and basically, you know, the levee, it was actually in January 2016, the levee was overtopped, and when it overtopped, it caused a breach or hole that now essentially a mile of the levee is now gone.
It's just gone there. And how extensive was the damage there in terms of farmland, highways, other infrastructure?
We had probably, 6 miles of road that no longer existed after, and then we had, another 15 miles of road that, had either erosion impacts, or we also, because there's so much current in this particular spot, that, I mean, it's depositing sand, and that's been the principal damage to the farmers. I mean, from the flooding, when we had flooding again this spring, again, significant flooding, we have over 2,000 acres of farm ground that's covered with anywhere from about 1 to 8 feet of sand.
I mean, yeah, you think of, Jim mentioned, the great dirt that we have in Illinois to grow things, but holy cow, that's a lot of sand to have to get rid of.
Yeah, I mean, right. I mean, when you start talking, much more than a foot, it's just not economically feasible to remove that, from the ground. So I mean, that's just ground that'll be lost.
That'll be lost at that point. So we've got, and that the economic effect of that is going to ripple, throughout. And that's people's livelihoods, people's homes, money for school districts, and other things that go on, certainly across the region. So we heard here, from Jim and from others that the severity of storms are likely to continue to increase. And it's for you all, I mean, it's not just storms that come through your area. Being right there on the Mississippi, it could be a storm anywhere north of you, and it's going to come down the river. What do you see needs to happen at this point in order to prevent that kind of flood damage? What needs to happen with that levee there?
Well, I mean, we put together a plan. We worked with IDNR, Office of Water Resources, to put together basically we have a set of design plans after 2016. But then the problem we got into this year was we had additional flooding. Well, where this is, the river's attempting to make like a cutoff and cut off the channel. So it creates a huge, what they call, scour hole. So the location we were going to build the levee, now it cut it out, in places, 20 to 30 foot deep. So the task of rebuilding the levee just got bigger.
And what about the cost? I mean, that's got to be also a major undertaking.
Yeah, I mean, that's the other thing is, we went through the Corps of Engineers, our levee district, that particular levee district's in the Corps. It's called PL 8499. It's their rehabilitation program. So after disaster, you make an application, which we did, and then the Corps will come in and there's a cost share of repairing your levee. But you have to do a benefit cost study associated with that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the benefit cost has to be one. Well, because this is a largely rural area with not a lot of homes, our benefit cost did not make it to one. So the Corps is not going to assist us with these repairs.
So the Army Corps will not assist in helping to build or pay for the repairs because the land there is deemed to be not valuable enough or as valuable as other land?
Well, what it is because, you know, it's a pretty rural area, you know, then we are currently still working on, you know, a pretty big FEMA flood buyout in that area. So the number of homes is going down. You know, that value, that, you know, the benefit side is, you know, has dwindled over the years. So the benefits, because, you know, you don't have any towns, you don't, you know, have any factories, you know, major infrastructure to get those benefits. And also because of the cost, because, you know, you're looking at rebuilding, you know, a mile of levee because it's such a large breach.
It's a large one, yeah.
We kind of got hit from both ends.
What about the state? I mean, you mentioned IDNR, Illinois Department of Natural Resources. They supported this in any way?
Oh, yeah. I mean, tremendously. I mean, the problem with most of the things with the state of Illinois, they don't have any funding, but they've been providing all the technical assistance on, you know, getting our permits, you know, doing the actual design, putting the plans together to rebuild the levee. I mean, they, you know, can use their time, their engineers and their people have been working on it. And, yeah, I mean, we would have never got to that point without their assistance.
So Jeff Denny, county engineer in Alexander County, Southern Illinois, talking about the effect of flooding in his region there of the state. In studio with us, Jim Angel, state climatologist with the Illinois State Water Survey. I mean, Jim, just coming back to the rivers here for a minute, I mean, what have we seen here in terms of, you know, as you talk about severity of storms, frequency of storms, that type of thing that, you know, more and more it seems, or at least coming from some of the effects of climate change, what do our rivers look like in Illinois? Are they starting to... That pathway, right, from north to south, I mean, that's a pathway for water.
Exactly. So any major storm that falls to the north of those guys is going to cause problems for them. And it's also aggravated by the fact that we have urban areas that have largely impermeable layers, their surfaces, so, you know, it's all concrete and asphalt, and so you get a lot of runoff from developed areas. And then even in the rural areas, we have an extensive network of tile drainage and the fields. So that also tends to pull the water off the fields very quickly and dump it into the rivers and streams. And so it just aggravates the problem. So it's kind of a multidimensional problem. So you just can't just point to one thing and say that's what we need to solve. It's a multidimensional problem.
And, you know, I mean, listening to Jeff, you know, and talking about sort of the option and trying to, you know, remake a levee as the river is just constantly sort of pushing around and under and through it, you know, can you engineer your way out of this problem?
You know, yeah, that's a good question. There's things you can do to kind of mitigate it, like, you know, changing how we manage the tile systems and how we deal put more green infrastructure in place in the city so we reduce runoff. But also, you know, after the 93 flood, there was a lot of talk about reverting some of these lands back to wetlands, which is actually a great buffer against flooding.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know about the specifics here, but, you know, it's certainly an option we should have on the table as we move forward.
Well, I mean, that's a good question. I mean, if you're a policymaker, you live in a community at risk of flooding, I mean, what things do you need to be looking at or doing right now?
Well, I think I think one thing is that you got to plan not only for any kind of flooding experience you might have had in the past, but think about that may not be sufficient for the future. In other words, you know, just because we've survived the flood of 93 or fill in the blank, that doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to survive the next round. And so they have to take that into account as well. And there's all these economic factors and changes in the rules and regulations, as your guest was pointing out, that can also come into play.
And Jeff, just coming back to you here for a minute, we've only got about 30 seconds left, but, you know, $16, $17 million needed to fix the levee there. I mean, where you guys stand right now? How are you looking?
Well, I mean, that's kind of the Corps' number. So, I mean, we could rebuild for a lot less than that. But, yeah, I mean, as far as, you know, a lot of our work has to be done, and it's always been done with the farmers, you know. I mean, in-kind work, I mean, them doing a lot of the work themselves.
So bringing out their own gear, working on maybe the designs from IDNR, but they're the ones actually physically building the levee back up.
Actually building it, yes.
All right. Jeff Denny, County Engineer, Alexander County, down in Sullivan, Illinois. Jeff, thank you for sharing that story, and good luck to y'all.
All right, thank you.
Jim Angel, State Climatologist, the Illinois State Water Survey. Appreciate your time as well.
Thank you.
That's all the time we have here for today. You can always visit find past shows on the NPR One app to search for the 21st, also available on iTunes and Android. All the links, directions for Alexa, every other way to contact us, phone, email, social media, that's all over at our website at 21stshow.org. You can follow us on Twitter to search for 21st Show. We live tweet during the show, more analysis, background about a lot of the things that we're talking about here. We're produced by Christine Herman, Ellen Montecilio, and Robert Holly. Technical Direction Engineering Support comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. I'm Scott Cameron. This is the 21st. We'll